श्री गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री श्री जगन्नाथ बलदेव सुभद्रा की जय, श्री गिरिराज महाराज की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री एकादशी की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि ओम। So good morning to all of you, Pranam. Thanks so much for coming. To all of you also connected online. And today we are having, at least today in the morning, in the evening we will continue with our series of on Brahma Stuti, the prayers of Brahma. But today in the morning we will have Ishtagosti, which basically means getting together, Gosti, getting together, group meeting, with Ishta, with our deity in the center, getting together for the sake of our deity, if you want to put it like that. That's how Sanskrit words, interesting. Which in practice means interaction, questions and answers in connection to the idea of to the idea of how to better increase our service disposition towards Bhagavan. So all of you are invited to present questions that you may have, topics you may like to hear about, to discuss, because this is basically the one of the main methods that we find in our tradition, questions and answers. You find that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna and Arjuna, in the Bhagavatam, Parikshit and Sukadev, and so many other sessions in the Bhagavatam, questions and answers, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Ramananda Rai, Mahaprabhu. Over and over again, these dynamics of learning are presented. Especially when we have something specific, and by presenting a question, that will also show where we are basically standing. Because ideally, we are asking something according to our adhikar. That's the idea. We will ask something that is relevant and pertinent to our particular stage. So some specific answer can come in that regard. So, are there any questions, any topics, something you may like to hear about? Also, the ones connected online can share them in the thread and we can address them. Who? Yeah, bye.
I have a question. I actually have two questions. Hope it's okay, because I think the first one might be a very quick answer. But I'll...
You never know.
The first question, just in related to the Brahma Vimohana Leela and Brahma having the realization, and it ultimately culminates in him taking birth as Haridas Thakur in Chaitanya Leela. And my question, this is the quick one, is when Brahma took birth as Haridas Thakur, did some other person take over the post of Brahma, or was there some other arrangement, how that happened? And my other question, I had a question if you could maybe speak a little bit about pride, because it's such a hard thing to overcome, and in my experience, so I'm talking about my own experience, of course, and you had mentioned something in a class a few days ago, how which was very helpful, because I think one thing, perspective really can help you to make progress in overcoming pride, and you had mentioned how any good quality we have or any progress we made in devotion is completely based on mercy, so it's nothing we've done. But it's just that pride can have such an effect on your everyday actions. You know, the stereotypical thing of you get a compliment and your pride runs away so quickly, and also in the negative aspect, you're afraid that your pride will be damaged, so you can act timid or something, or not that stereotypical way of being boastful, but still you're being kind of pulled by your pride. So it just seems there's so many layers to tackle it and take it away. So I just didn't know if you had some recommendations of practice or more perspective to help with that.
Okay. Thanks so much for the questions. Regarding the first question, actually one devotee made the exact same question in Michigan, in the Harmony Collective, when we were visiting there one month ago, because we were also sharing some Brahma Stuti verses, based on some of the stuti there. So I repeat just in case the question for those who online, maybe I don't know how much they are hearing the question. So the question is, and just to clarify that point, we are going through the prayers of Brahma. Brahma is, it is mentioned that Brahma is born in Gaur Lila as Haridas Thakur. And basically, the idea is that what Brahma wanted to attain in his ideal of perfection was fully possible in the figure of Haridas Thakur, in the context of Gaur Lila. As we'd say the other day, Brahma, during the Brahma Vimohan Lila, he engaged in a number of aparats, interestingly. He offended the form of Krishna by considering this ordinary form at one moment. He offended the associates of Krishna by trying to kidnap them. He offended the Lila of Krishna by interrupting the picnic. No? So he had a good list. But somehow, although he offended, if you will, Rupa, Guna, Parikar, Lila, all these different aspects, the name of Krishna, stayed with him, especially in his next birth as Haridas Thakur. And the name stayed with him quite a lot. No? He became the Nam Acharya. So that's also an important point in this connection that, of course, I plan to speak in detail when we finish the whole series, and we will go to the happy end of the story of Brahma attaining the ultimate perfection as Haridas, the lesson for us is, even if you commit aparat to these other aspects of Bhagavan, the name is most merciful. But of course, be careful of not offending the name on the strength of, oh, the name is so merciful that I can even offend the name and he will stay with me. That's not the best attitude to deal with the name. So, but the point is, even if you fail in so many other directions, name's still there and can give you everything. This is the example of Brahma in the form of Haridas, that we know he attained the ultimate perfection to the point that when he passed away, and that's a whole different discussion, but very interesting one, describing Chaitanya Charitamrita, the passing away of Haridas Thakur. I mean, there's a whole chapter dedicated to the passing away of Haridas Thakur. You basically do not find any other detailed description of the passing away of anyone in Gaur Lila. So, what to speak of a whole chapter about the passing away of someone, but in case of Haridas Thakur, that's highlighted. And as we know, he's not only accompanied by Mahaprabhu, but Mahaprabhu himself starts to dance with his body when he passed away, and then he, with his own hands, starts to dig the samadhi, basically, you know, to make the hole for putting the body there. And on top of that, and he also bathes the body on the ocean in Puri, dancing with him himself. All Mahaprabhu himself is doing. And he's declaring with four mouths, it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita. He's chanting the glories of Haridas Thakur and how his body is totally spiritual, and he wants to make that point by taking it on his arms, dancing with it, putting it himself in samadhi, like making this point. Diksha kale bhakta kare atma samarpana. Chaitanya Charitamrita says, when hey kare Krishna kare atma sam. In the moment of diksha, and now this is an interesting way of thinking about what's then diksha. In the moment of diksha, when you make of your own atma, of your own self, a whole offering, a complete offering to Bhagavan, Krishna considers the body of that devotee as equal to his. And Mahaprabhu is showing that in that lila, you know, taking Haridas Thakur's body along with him and baby. So implying, of course, diksha is to be taken as a process. No, it's not just, okay, I received diksha, so what's next now? I already had that. What's the next thing to have? Oh no, you didn't understand. You have to do something with that. Sri Guru gave you, if you will, the seed. You have to do some work with that. It's like if I give you the seed and you ask me, okay, I have the seed. Yes, but the fruit is not there yet. You have to put the seed, you have to prepare the ground, put the seed. Mahaprabhu gave this example. You have to become a gardener. So eventually, the bhakti lata beach, the vine of devotion, the seed that is given, Guru Krishna Prasad Pai Bhakti Lata Beach, eventually that will blossom into the form of prem phala, or the fruit of divine love. So anyhow, I don't want to get sidetracked by the question, but just giving some context because maybe some of the devotees may not know about this connection between Brahma, Haridas, and of course Brahma is, for example, in Gaur-Ganodesh, Deepika, and other treatises which kind of show who is who in Gaur-Lila and Krishna-Lila. Brahma is connected with Haridas. So in the form of Haridas Thakur, Brahma attained his ultimate perfection in Gaur-Lila as Haridas Thakur, and in Krishna-Lila in Sakya-rasa, which is what he asked for, as we mentioned these days in the beginning of creation. So that said, the question is about, okay, so we hear that Brahma is a post, right, that someone has to be in for this whole thing to happen, if you will. He's instrumental. He's not a primary creator, but a secondary creator. Shastra uses the term sarga and visarga. So sarga means Krishna is actually the one who is behind the whole thing, the one who is providing the elements, and Brahma is the one who is making sense of the elements, basically putting them together as the architect of the cosmos, if, to put it very simply. So if Brahma, of course there is one Brahma, and if Brahma at one point attains perfection, the question is like, what will happen? I mean, if Brahma attained perfection as Haridas Thakur, that happened a few hundreds years ago, we are speaking about one particular Brahma. There is one Brahma in each universe, and the whole duration of the universe lasts for the lifetime of Brahma. Generally, we have this type of definition. Of course, Brahma's time is different from ours, but the whole duration is like 100 years of Brahma, which for us is a number that we cannot even pronounce. Has lots of zeros. So the question is, so if Brahma attains perfection at Haridas Thakur, which means he went to Golok, so what happens with Brahma? Is there no more Brahma from that moment till the end of Brahma's life? It seems that Brahma's life ended before or something. So are we without Brahma, without architect, and that's why the world is so out of order now. Maybe that's the reason. So that's an interesting question. And of course, this has not been like directly that I know addressed in Shastra specifically, like what's going on. So we can basically conjecture regarding some different possibilities in that connection, which I would say, according to what I can say, goes in two directions. One of them, you can say, okay, Brahma attained perfection at Haridas Thakur, so Bhagavan, Vishnu himself, covered the post of Brahma for the time being. Because sometimes we hear, when there's nobody qualified to be in the post of Brahma, Vishnu himself is doing that. Because as we said yesterday, you have to be pretty qualified to be Brahma, on some level of qualification, 100 lifetimes of perfect varna ashram, or 108, just in case. That's not so easy. So it may be difficult at the particular moment. I have no candidates this time. So Vishnu himself does that. When there's nobody as qualified as Brahma, as to be a Brahma. And we could say, or when Brahma gets too qualified and becomes Haridas Thakur and attains Golok, Vishnu enters and fills the void for the remaining time. That's one way of putting that. Or another way of putting that will be that still that Brahma, he attained perfection as Haridas Thakur, but somehow he remains performing his duty as Brahma till the end of his life, and then he enters final destination, if you want to put it like that. There's a place for considering that also. So again, those will be my main two proposals. I don't want to say you pick the one who like you the most or something, but my point is, yeah, some of these topics have not been directly addressed in Shastras, but there is place for what's called Shastra Yukti, which means like to use our logic and thinking process in the context of what Shastra says. Not first our logic and then quote Shastra to fit your logic. but first Shastra and then use your logic in the context of Shastra, which is a whole different conversation that I make in my book. Because sometimes when we speak about certain topics, we try to justify them by invoking our common sense, which sometimes is not very commonsensical, but we think it is. So we bring logic or common sense, which is limited, as we know. Logic, tarko apratishta anat, says Shastra. Through tarka, which means logic, you go nowhere. That's how it says, basically, Shastra. You go nowhere, only by logic. In terms of matters connected to the absolute, to the divine, which is so way beyond logic, as we are seeing these days in the Brahma Stuti. I mean, Krishna is like inside, outside, in unlimited medium size. Logic collapses in 5 seconds by hearing those things. So first we have to go through revelation, through Shastra, and then you can exercise your logic in that perimeter, not outside. Outside tarko pratishtanat. Achintya kalo jibhavat natamstar kina jojayat prakriti vyam param jachat tadachintya shalakshanam, says Shastra. That issues that are achintya in nature cannot be grasped by logic. You have to go through to take another transrational method. So I don't want to get sidetracked, but it's an important point in connection to the whole thing. Because we can say, oh, Maharaj, you're speculating with these things that you're saying about Brahma, because nobody say that. Yeah, I agree. But speculation, mental speculation, as Srila Prabhupada will call, it basically has to do with you use your head without first going to Shastra. So that's mental speculation. But when you go to Shastra and you use your head to make sense of what Shastra is given to you and to elaborate and think about that, that's not only something legal, but something necessary. I mean, you have a head, you have some thinking, you have to do something with that. So there's a place to exercise that in that context. Indeed, the very term achintya, which we were speaking these days and a little bit joking about that sometimes, because speaking especially regarding this achintya button, that when someone asks you something you don't know, you're like, I have the atomic option. We were also speaking about yesterday about atomic bombs and things like that. So you have the atomic option, achintya. No. So Maharaj, like your question, like how does that Brahma remains Brahma because it's imperfect? What to do? I don't know what to say. My God, achintya, bhai, it's achintya. Like, stop thinking, do not anymore ask those questions that actually show how I do not know what to say. So, achintya. End of the question. Next question. Achintya means inconceivable, no? But of course, it's a word that can be abused, no? Because you can just basically promote like shallow thinking or not thinking at all in the name of inconceivability or whatever. But achintya, Srila Jiva Goswami defines it in the in his Sarva Sambhat, in his commentary on the Sandarvas, I think Paramatma Sandarva, he basically says, achintya are those things, I mean, something achintya will remain achintya as long as you do not approach Shastra. That's the official definition of achintya in our Sampradaya. What something, when something is inconceivable, he says, when you do not go to Shastra. Unless and until you go to Shastra, many things will remain inconceivable. But when you go to Shastra, those things that are inconceivable will become conceivable by Shastra's grace and by your application of yukti or logic in the context of Shastra, but not otherwise. Not, for me, this is like that, so Shastra must be supporting this somehow. You try to fill some verse and stretch it and accommodate so it fills your logic. That's not the process. That's the opposite way around. So anyhow, some brief words in connection to this. So there is place for this type of exercise, if you will. Shastra Yukti, mentioned by Rupa Goswami. Exercise our logic in the context of Shastra. Regarding your second question, which I repeated briefly, it's about pride, or basically, if we can share some words about pride, which is a pretty particular complex reality to deal with, especially if you officially want to overcome that. Because if you do not care for that, pride just swallows your whole existence and you are comfortable with it. I mean, that creates so much discomfort, but but you are not concerned about even acknowledging that. But if you are a spiritual practitioner and you know, okay, that may be one of the many things to deal with, and on many layers, it's not only like, okay, tell me what I have to deal with. Yes, but also each one of those situations have so many layers. And most of the layers probably we are not even aware of yet. We will be start to discover as we deal with them. Because in the beginning we may think, okay, I have pride, I know, and I acknowledge, but we acknowledge just what we can see at that moment. The level of pride that is like the tip of the ice, as they say. No. They say like this, right?
Okay.
Iceberg, not ice, the tip of the iceberg. So and as you realize, oh my God, it was the tip of the iceberg. There's something called iceberg which lies below this whole surface of stuff. And the tip was just the tip. No, and for me it was the whole iceberg. And we shouldn't get discouraged by that, no? So some words about how to deal with pride. Of course, our acharyas have cautioned us about that, just very strongly, just to be aware this is not a joke, this is something, again, not to be neurotic also, because we have to create the proper balance of, how to say, pride, especially with pride, things so subtle as such, because pride is not only some very gross thing, like I will come in front of you and say, you know what, I'm the best devotee in the whole Gaudiya community. I'm totally convinced. And that's only because of my merit. Sorry, what?
Maybe you are.
No. Please do not cheat me like that. No. Act as my friend and tell me, no, Maharaj, you're going crazy. Please stop doing that. If I will be, I wouldn't be saying those things. So, but my point is, pride is not only that. No? And of course, here comes the very tricky thing, because we sometimes think that pride is certain thing. So whenever that happens, that's pride. And whatever does not happen, that's not pride. But pride or humility, which is would be the opposite, it's not something that you can measure externally. That it has a lot to do with what's going on internally. And you cannot sometimes see that. Immediately, at least. And you have to take the time to examine. And not so much examine other people, but... Because you can also go in life like just, oh, okay, let's see how proud they are, how proud he is, how humble they are. And probably all that exercise is a distraction of what's taking place at home. And the same thing when we hear these definitions of adhikar in Shastra. Hutam adhikar, kanishta, madhya. This is not just to write your list and start to like scan every person. You are a kanishta. You are also a kanishta. Everyone is a kanishta, except for me. It seems like I am the only one who has the ability to discern who they are. So I'm for sure more than kanishta, but everyone else, this type of, that's not the idea. It's more to be introspective and be strict with yourself and merciful with others, if you will. So pride is pretty subtle stuff. Externally, it may seem as humility. You can even, as a devotee, learn how to say, like, to play a show of external humility, like that's a formula, and everyone will, without even subconsciously, not even not like wanting to cheat everyone, but subconsciously you resort to that mechanism where you, Jai, Pranam, Dandava to all of you, and you meet, oh wow, this is so humble. No? And you can make like an external, like, the more you put your shoulders like this, is the more humble you are, like, oh. But maybe internally you are just wanted everyone to think you are humble, basically. And to convince the environment how humble you are, and then to remain in a comfort zone of, I'm humble. So I don't have to work on my pride. But pride is very tricky, you know. And again, it will present itself even in the disguise of humility, and vice versa. Humility may seem to be pride, and not necessarily it's pride. Like the famous story that we share sometimes with this disciple of Ramanujacharya, who was he was very capable in all areas of service. Basically, he will sing very beautifully. He will cook incredibly. He knows Shastra so well. He will be many virtues and attributes. So someday some of his god brothers will tell him, "Oh, you cook so nicely." And he said, "Yes." "And you sing better than a Gandharva." I say, "Yes." "And you know so well the scriptures." I say, "Yes." So they were like, "Oh my gosh, he's becoming proud. He's taking merit or something," they thought. So they went to their guru, Ramanujacharya, and they were concerned for his god brother and asked and told them, "Gurudev, it's not that we want to report him, but we are just concerned for our god brother. And every time we are mentioning to him, you do this so nicely, you do this," he say, "Yes, always, yes, yes." So we are worried that he may engage being proud. So Ramanujacharya is called him. So he goes and he asks, "Your god brothers have come to me. They are concerned about you in a healthy way because they say that they ask you, you cook nicely, you say yes, you sing nicely, you say yes, you know Shastra perfectly, you say yes. So you please tell me what's going on." And the disciple told, "Well, Guru Maharaj, if I cook nicely, it's by your mercy. So if I deny the effect of your mercy on me, that wouldn't be proper. I would be ungrateful. So by saying I cook nicely, I'm actually accepting by your grace I cook nicely. And the same with all the other things. Whatever I can do nicely is only by your mercy. So I cannot deny that. So I have to accept it. Yes, I cook nicely. By your grace, by Gurudev's grace." To follow my point. So it seems proud, but it's another level of humility. So there are levels of humility that can be misconstrued if you don't have proper appreciation. Also, there are levels of pride that can be seen as the opposite if we don't have a trained eye. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, someone like Raghunath Das Goswami, for example, in his Manasiksha, he will use these extreme graphic depictions to speak about pratishtha, which are all connected, no? Pride, like a tigress, like a chandala, crazy woman who eats this and drinks that, and very gross, monster-like depictions of all these different anarthas for us to... Okay, I have to... That's not, pleasurable to maintain them. So first of all, this discussion, this is not a nice thing, so try to acknowledge that. Of course, while acknowledging that, we shouldn't be over-identified with that. You know, the fact that I have pride doesn't mean that I am pride. And you yourself say, "I have pride." You don't say, "I am pride." So in the very root shows that you are not that. You know? When you say, "I am angry," you don't say, "I am anger." "I am proud," but you don't say, "I am pride." So even in the way intuitively how you express yourself, you know that you are not that thing. That's not part of the constitution of the Atma. So that's important, because if we don't have that clear, we can be really over-identified with that and get neurotic and get depressed and get discouraged and think, "I am such a monster. I have no hope whatsoever. And this process is so nice, but I am so ugly. So this is too much for me. I will stop practicing." That can happen if we don't know how to work with these things and, again, go in the neurotic side, over-identify with our anarthas, and forgetting how powerful is Mahaprabhu's grace. Because no matter how proud you are, you tell me, "Maharaj, I'm the most proud devotee in the whole world." I will say, "Yeah, but Mahaprabhu's mercy is more powerful than all your pride put together." I don't know how proud you are, but even if you tell me I'm the most proud person on earth, still Mahaprabhu's mercy is more powerful than your pride. Now if you tell me, "No, my pride is more merciful than Mahaprabhu's grace," then you are the most proud person on earth. I can give you officially the label. Because if you think that your pride is so great and big and powerful that it's above Mahaprabhu's mercy, You are really proud. But still, Mahaprabhu's mercy is more powerful. So we will make some chain of prayer for you so Mahaprabhu's, Nityananda Prabhu especially, can do something about it. So I would say that the way, of course, there is no magical formula that now I will reveal to you the secret so you can be devoid of pride from now to the next weekend. That's not happening. No? And hopefully nobody is selling that magical retreat. No? Weekend and leave the weekend without pride or something. That, for sure, they will have to pay a lot, I'm sure, those type of things. In every sense. But it begins with acknowledging the possibility that that thing is there. No? Again, because sometimes we may not even open to that. I mean, some people may not be willing to accept they are proud. So that in itself speaks about their pride. No? I'm not willing that anyone can tell me anything. No, only myself. If I see myself, it's okay. That's the only way of... That's the work like that. So we should be open. Probably some other people is seeing things in me that I am not seeing. Especially if you are a Gaudiya Vaishnava, if you have a guru, if you have sadhus around your life, you should trust their vision more than your own vision, with all respect. It's not to downplay you as a person, but just to be realistic and not be overtly proud to think, I know myself better than anyone else. Probably not. Probably you are too much engrossed in what you think you are, and that makes for being distracted for you from who you actually are. And a sadhu will see you for who you are, actually, free from upadis, free from designations, as the Bhagavad Gita mentions. Someone in Sattvagun, for example, we will be seeing the Atma. Someone in Rajagun will be seeing dualistic perception, mind, man, woman, black, white, race, whatever, political party, and so on. And of course, the sadhu will see even beyond the Atma, in the sense, will see the Atma and the potential of the Atma in connection to Atma. So we should be willing to to let the sadhus share their opinion on our life. So if they suggest, maybe this, maybe that, or they are trying to inspire us, please try to be introspective about how pride is going on in your life. So acknowledgement is important, to be open to the possibility that may be happening, and to, of course, observe ourselves, and even if that helps, if we want to give some practical advice, if you will, is, of course, to begin with, try to be close to people that you feel that are more humble than you. And of course, be ready to pay the price of that, because that will make your pride come to the surface. And that's why sometimes people say, okay, if you go to a sacred place, okay, be ready for that, because there may be a contrast in perception, because you will be surrounded by so much purity that whatever is not purity will be easily noticed. And it's not that the holy place is bringing impurity. The impurity was there, but you are not seeing that. You just needed to contrast that with its opposite, and then you see, on some level at least, what's what. So similarly, that's a good exercise always. If you feel, I don't know, I need to work on pride, get closer to those that you feel they are more humble than you, and the very association and way they conduct, you naturally will, like, not compare in a neurotic way, but just contrast and pay attention how I am dealing with that. Again, not like becoming neurotic, I am not as humble as that pure devotee, and you start to imitate, I'm not saying that, but creating some contrast, it sheds light on what's actually going on. Because if you are just surrounded by people that is as proud as you, or worse, you may feel, I'm not that proud. They are so much prouder than me, so I am relatively fine, okay. In comparison with them, yes. But what's the litmus test, as they say, the thermometer. But you can be complacent in that sense, no? Like I don't know, you are a devotee from, let's say, 10 years, and and maybe you should be, or 20 years practicing, if you are practicing, because you can, one thing is you were initiated, and other thing is you have been practicing the whole time, and you can tell me, okay, Maharaj, I could do it better, but I think I'm okay. I look back 20 years back, and I feel that I'm better than 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I was, whatever, serial killer or doing some stuff. So I will accept, okay, that's great, but that's not the only way to measure your progress, because if not, you can be complacent that whatever you need to, you are called for further progress. You say, no, but I'm better than 35 years ago. I no longer drink this, I no longer take... Okay, I acknowledge that, but that's not the only way to compare and to measure and to make progress, because if not, you will always remain there, because you are always in a better position than you were 30 years ago. You follow my point? So you need to put the other way around also, to compare with other types of situations or personalities, which will, again, not make you neurotic that I'm too fallen, I'm too far, this is not for me, I'm not saying that, but association, that's why Rupa Goswami say, when he speaks sadhu sangha, he describes sadhu sangha should include three ingredients, snigdasya, satavara, and sajatiya. So, in this case, I'm concentrated on svatavara. No. Svajatya means of similar nature. Snigdasya means affectionate. There has to be affection in between. That's the currency. But svatavara means the sadhu sangha you establish, those sadhus have to be higher than you. No. I'm not saying that every person you relate to in the context of sadhu sangha is higher than you. I mean, one should feel that, but sometimes one is also relating with people who is, if you will, junior, or you are more acting like a well-wisher to them. There's place for that relationship. Rupa Goswami mentions that you have to relate with equals. Also, that's an interesting challenge. Also, another one, but also with people who is higher than you. So that again, that the very experience of being unrelated with someone higher than you doesn't mean just physical proximity, because sometimes that's not available. But you have to establish some commitment of service in a relationship with people who is higher than you. Check some balances with some higher sadhu that is watching over my progress. And that has to be voluntary. I have to choose that. I have to decide doing that. It's not that that will be imposed on me. Like, you reveal your mind to that person, and you send every week how you are doing actually, and you share your Facebook password to that sadhu so he can check if you are doing nonsense or not. It cannot be like some dictatorship. But we should feel the need naturally. So I would like to, yeah, keep in touch and keep like reporting my inner self to those higher personalities, and as much as I can to be in the close proximity, because again, that creates epiphany, that creates moments of revelation when you realize where you are, not only where he or she is. That's a part of that. If you are close to your guru for some time, you kind of, wow, no, she's such. But also the other part of the equation is where I am, in relation to that. Remember, guru is our own potential appearing in front of us. So the logic will be always that I'm with guru, and guru is showing me all that I can be. So it's unavoidable that you will feel, I can be all this, but what I am now, but all I can be, and what I am now. What I am now, again, not to chastise myself, but just to establish where I am now. I mean, I need to know where I am now. And as accurate as possible. Because you have to go know, as my Guru Maharaj says, these two things. Where you are now, and where do you want to be? So the Guru is the one who clearly shows where do you want to be, all that you can be. And by his example, her example, instruction, creates this reflection in us. And where I am now, in relation to what I want to be? And what should I do from here to reach here? What's the in-between journey? So, yeah, to deal with pride, basically, again, there's no one single magical formula, and with for every person it may work differently, but basically one has to be under this close company, guidance, open to that, engaging in sadhana, acknowledging that pride may be there. That's for me one of the definitions of anartha nivritti. Anartha nivritti means like getting free from anarthas, let's say, in very brief words. But anartha nivritti is not a practice unto itself. You don't practice anartha nivritti. You engage in bhajan kriya, and that creates anartha nivritti. So I would say that anartha nivritti means to engage in bhajan kriya, being aware of the of my anarthas, and not identified with, but aware of. So, because you can practice bhajan, you can engage in bhakti without having this like recognition. There is pride in my life. There is in this way, in this stage, is playing out in this way, and I need to work with. So anartha nivritti will be to practice having that awareness. That will create anartha nivritti. Because if you are not aware of your anarthas, how there will be anartha nivritti? Of course, we could say, in one sense, bhakti is very powerful and will purify our hearts of things that we are not even aware of. That's also real. But also, it's real that we should do our part as much as best as we can of trying to recognize the field, if you will, what's there. No, we may not be able to see everything, and for sure Harinam and sadhana will purify of so many things that we don't have a clue that they are there, and better not to know, it's too much. But what we can see, what we can know by our own effort, we should do that, we should try that. So pride is in the top 5, if you will, on the list, not to say the top 1. And it's the exact opposite of what does it mean to be a devotee, basically. So that's really unbecoming. I mean, if there is something that does not characterize a devotee, it's pride. If you define a devotee, the very thing, first thing you will say mostly is humility. Sanatana Goswami says humility and prem are synonymous. So basically he's saying, if you want prem, better you're humble. In other words, pride is the worst thing you can do in your prem project. So one has to, yeah, be aware of that, trying to remain close to those who are more advanced than us in terms of this particular internal process. Try to determine as much as we can which is the version of pride that I'm dealing with in this particular chapter, how it's playing itself out. And when it stops playing itself out in that way, remain attentive. It's not that it disappears completely. It's just now becoming more subtle. And again, not with the mentality, there's some enemy there that wants to defeat, because sometimes we enter into this. I mean, sometimes it's spoken like that to create the proper kshatriya mood for battling. But it's not that pride is some person inside of you that wants, I don't know, some ambassador of Satan or something that wants to make you fall. There's nobody there. It's just that you are feeding, you are incorporating some samskars in that particular direction. Like I like to say, sometimes when you eat and you eat junk food, so you put junk food into your stomach and the stomach is chastised by you. Basically, there's nobody there. There's not one person called stomach, but stomach will react giving you pain. You follow? It's not that the stomach is bad, has something against you. It seems more that you have something against your stomach by giving that junk food. So the same way, the mind is like the stomach of the subtle body. So if you feed the mind with junk samskars, the mind will react. And the stomach will react. It will give you pain. It will make you go crazy. But it's not that there's somebody there. Mind, subtle body is inert matter. Inert, subtle. psychic matter, but it's still inert. It's not, it doesn't have a life of its own. But what's the food you are giving to it? So pride is part of that drunk food, if you will. So again, my point is, one has also to develop this type of non-neurotic attitude towards, okay, pride is there and wants to make me fall and has that intention. No, it's not like that. It's that you develop certain mechanisms and way of dealing with reality which are totally toxic, and you are just learning how to unfold them. So yeah, pride is on a certain level. You work on that, it will become more subtle. You work on that, it will become more subtle, till it disappears completely. And in order to finally disappear, it has to become more subtle till it disappears. So the other day, one Vaishnavi, close friend of mine, and she was like asking us, and interestingly, she sent an email, and the title of the email said Pride. No? I said, okay, interesting. And she was expressing like, okay, I'm finding difficulty with pride. And of course, I know the person, and I know that person is not proud. Of course, what does it mean it's not proud? It's not that it's not proud at any level, but when you hear someone say, I'm proud, you may think, oh, like showing off, but it's not nothing like that. I know that person is sincere, sadhaka, having very deep realizations, but still feels pride is difficult to get rid of. And of course, for me, that's okay. That's part of the result of your bhajan. I mean, you're doing it nicely, so you are really realizing how difficult it is dealing with pride. I mean, you follow my point, no? That you get to that conclusion doesn't actually mean that you are in the wrong situation, but you are starting to have a glimpse of this, how subtle these things can be. That speaks how much you have eradicated them in your life. Still, they remain maybe on a subtle level, but that shows how much you have transcended all the grossest manifestations of that. So still, you are, and you are willing to acknowledge that, and you are asking for help. So that shows your humility. And one recommendation that came in the interaction was, again, that may help for some, not for everyone, but you can write, as we were speaking today, you can write every single day something, some meditation, some reflection on how you work with pride today, how it was your pride struggle today. Now, how you feel you were tested by pride, if you will, today, or you failed by it, or you were and like a way of bringing to your conscious side those things that sometimes may be inhabiting the subconscious. You follow my point? Because sometimes all the things, pride and so on, are there, but they are in the background, behind the curtains, by puppeting the whole show, moving you, without you being aware of that. You just think, that's me. That's my personality. That's who I am. But when you officially say, okay, let's concentrate in this week or in this month or as long as I feel it necessary on pride or whatever, on fear, on distrust or whatever, or all of them, maybe pick one so not to be overwhelmed. And let's bring that, which for sure I know it is on some layer, let's bring that to the, how to say, foreground, to the spotlight. So, and you became conscious of that, and you make an endeavor, okay, today, pride. What happened today with pride? And you start to think and to reflect, and to bring your attention there. Next day. So that's a way of becoming more conscious of what's actually going on. Because if not, it's not that pride is not there, but you are just like too distracted to deal with that. That's one of our problems, distraction. So the solution to distraction is attention. And attention is, you have to discipline yourself sometimes to be focused on something. It's not, it doesn't happen just by magic. It's not that I tell you, okay, from today on, for the next week, be the whole day observing how pride is working. And you may try, but moments in the day is like somewhere else. But if you see it, okay, official moment of the day, my 10-15 minutes of reflection, I will write on this, you kind of force the whole system to focus in that direction, no? So that sometimes may work. So anyhow, I mean, we can say so many things, but the rest is practice, no, sadhana. I mean, there's nothing that can replace sadhana. No? I mean, sadhana is, and again, sadhana I do not mean just mechanically doing stuff outside, but just conducting with the proper spirit and the proper need and proper association. So I hope that helps on some level. And you are not alone in the struggle, just in case. No? That's an important point, because sometimes we can feel so much drowning in an ocean of pride. But it's important to understand, I'm not the only one drowning here. So we are all drowning together. Of course, we are not drowning. There is so much help to not drown. But sometimes that helps to also deal with the situation in a more sustainable way. Guru Bhakti has some addition to the contribution.
I remember, like, for example, in Prabhupada's books, often there is a term, false pride.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so is there, and psychologists often say there's something like healthy pride. And sometimes I think Guru Maharaj says, like, well, you don't have to be ashamed that you're a devotee. So that's like a kind of healthy pride. Or, so is there, you know, is there anything like healthy pride in Gaudiya tradition, we can say, or in behavior or sadhana, or is it just a kind of term?
It all depends, as we were speaking yesterday, what you understand by the word. No? Because you can say pride, and what triggers there is the question. No? Because if there is a way that you conceive that in a way that there is place for that, I have no problem. I'm just referring to pride as what we usually think of, which, as Prabhupada will say, false pride or false ego. It's kind of, he used the two of them like interchangeable, no? Like a false sense of being, or false sense of doership, like the Gita says, prakriti kriyamanani, hankara bimudatma. Hankara, the very word hankara means, I consider myself the doer, and nothing else is influencing me or something, and that's like, that's not who you are, really. But yeah, Guru Maharaj, for example, he will used to say, we are proud to be humble members of the Bhaktivinoda Parivar. But he immediately ties the word proud to humble.
Yeah.
Like to qualify the idea, no? Just to make sure that, be careful what you understand by proud, no? So we are proud to be humbled members of the Bhaktivinoda Parivar. So in that pride, if you pay attention, what's the meaning of that is, we feel fortunate to have the opportunity of having received that, being part of that, and we will take a stance to protect that, to represent that. That even may seem to be proud from the outside eye, like, why do you are acting like, but
it's more like confident.
Yeah, exactly.
Mishwas.
And that's an important point that we spoke yesterday recently with devotees. One thing is to be confident, another thing is to be proud. Like, for example, famous example is when Sri Radha knows that in one particular situation, only she can give Krishna the highest pleasure, and he needs that. She will make herself, he will pull everyone else on the side, and she will appear in the spotlight to provide that pleasure. So again, externally it seems, who she thinks she is? I mean, she's putting everyone on the side and just taking the first spotlight position, but only with the attitude of, at this moment, Krishna needs this, and I realize that I can only provide that. So, it's, strictly speaking, it's full of humility, because it's not in consideration of me, for me, anything coming for me, I'm not the center, just in the spirit of providing service, providing pleasure. So, it may seem like proud externally, but internally it's humility. And again, the opposite way around. Your guru may ask the disciple, please do this service, and you may think, oh no, I'm so falling, I cannot do it. That's not humility. Because Srila Siddharamas will say, humility in practice means to follow the instruction. Of course, you have to understand what this means, and this is not something to abuse. But if your Gurudev is asking you something, it means that he knows that you will be able to do it. He has faith you will be able to. He's empowering you to do it by the very act of fact of giving the instruction. So you cannot tell him, oh no, Gurudev, I'm so fallen that I won't be able to do that. you don't know how fallen I am, so please stop asking me these things because I won't be able to do it. That's actually pride, disguising itself. No? So many similar things in that way. No? Like, for example, I don't know, please, can you sing kirtan? Oh, I'm so fallen, I cannot sing. That's why you should sing. You need to be redeemed. So we are not, no? You follow my point. Or sometimes, I don't know, you are, that happens, you're giving the class, someone makes you give the class, and they put you like a fancy seat like this one. No, that is Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai. So this fancy seat is there, and someone tells you, okay, you will speak Harikatha, please sit here. And you may say, oh no, this seat is too big for me. Of course, what's the reply to that? The seat is not for you. The seat is for the Bhagavatam. The seat is for Harikatha. You are just an instrument. You follow. So it appeared that you were be humble. Oh no, it's too big for me. But actually, that's pride, because you are thinking, it's for me, and it is not for you. So real humility is, okay, I'm sitting here, but in the spirit of rendering service, of course, easier said than done. No? You have to really walk the talk internally, because you can be sitting and receiving 108 garlands and one puja after another. No, only in the spirit of representing the Param. If you have the realization, okay, but if you don't have, better you don't do that, because it's too much. So this has also to be examined according to your adhikar. You have to be able to determine what's my limit, my capacity to deal with this now, with this level of whatever. That's why Rupa Goswami say, one should not accept many disciples, open many temples, or write many books. And when someone asked Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, he was saying that, as you know, he was explaining this. And one disciple told him, but Gurudev, it seems that you are doing exactly the opposite. Opening one temple after another, thousands of disciples, so many books. And he replied, that's a question of personal capacity. Like implying, what's many disciples? What's many? For some people, to have one disciple is many. For some people, to be a disciple is too much. And for other people, to have 30,000 disciples, like whatever, Narottam Das Thakur or something, it was sustainable. So it's a matter of personal capacity, what is too much or too little. You follow, it's not a fixed number. So you have to pay attention what's your adhikar. So the point again, going back to the idea is, yeah, confidence can be mistaken with pride, but it's not the same. Actually, there's place for deep confidence with deep humility, like the example of Sri Radha that I gave, and that's the highest form of humility. Because humility, again, in the words of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, is that which is absent in the spirit of enjoyment. In other words, humility means absence of the enjoying spirit. And pride means I see myself at the center, enjoying spirit. So which external form it will take, so many different forms can take. To be confident doesn't mean that you are confident with you in the center. But I'm so confident, and that should be part of Saranagati. Saranagati means, for example, Rakshishatiti Vishwaso. I have full faith that Krishna will protect me. That's a form of confidence, strong one. If you really believe that, you may be doing things that seem like, who he thinks he is doing that? Why? But maybe the internal feeling is, I have full confidence that Krishna is protecting me. And Srila Prabhupada was so confident, so bold. For some people, that was shocking. That was like too much. But again, it was not like from pride. It was not like, it's me, it's about me. But it's about my Gurudev, Mahaprabhu, in service to them. It's not about myself. So as we know, I mean, almost every person on earth, if you say Hare Krishna, say, oh yeah, I hear Hare Krishna. You say Prabhupada, maybe not many people would say, ah, Prabhupada. So my point is, he wanted the Maha Mantra and the message to be on the fore. He didn't want to be himself in the center. So the spirit was that, full humility. So So there is place for that as well. Okay. Thank you for your question and the contribution. So, what else? They're offering the boga now. Yeah, we may have time for one more question, maybe. I don't know. Anyone has some question? Yeah, Tarun.
Thank you for the beautiful explanations that you shared with us. I was thinking a little bit in different direction, and it's connected with meditation in the practice of bhakti. And there is a specific case in Bhagavatam, there is this verse,
Bhakti Yoga Paribhavitari Chara.
In the specific way we meditate on our Ishtadeva, he appears in that specific bhava form. So I was thinking about Prahlad Maharaj, because it's mentioned in Bhagavatam, he was meditating on Krishna. And afterwards we see, okay, Narasimhadev appears, but also this form of Krishna, Narasimhadev, it's more connected generally with Vishnu, not with Krishna. So this was, because Lakshmi appeared, you know, it's pointing to Vishnu. So I'm always wondering why it's...
Yeah, I get the point. I'll repeat the question because they're telling me here that they cannot hear from the online connection. So here, Tarun Krishna is asking about one verse from the Bhagavatam, famous verse. Brahma is speaking that verse, third canto, from Bhakti Yoga Paribhavita Hritsaroja Sutrakshit Aptas. And so on, which basically says that according to the mood in which one meditates on one's Ishtadev, there will be corresponding reciprocation, or Bhagavan will appear in that particular form that one is contemplating one's deity. And the question is, well, what about Prahlad Maharaj? Because in Shastra it is mentioned that Prahlad Maharaj's Ishtadev is not Narasimhadev, but it's Krishna. But we see that And he, Prahlad, in connection to the nine methods of bhakti, he's the personification of smaranam, which means remembrance or meditation, you can say. So he was engaging in smaranam pretty nicely. He's the, I like the example of that. And his Ishtadev is Krishna, but in the lila that he is most well known for, it seems that Krishna is not appearing. His Ishtadev is not appearing in reciprocation to his remembrance, but half man, half lion, Narahari is appearing, and Tarun Krishna mentioned that after the whole killing of Hiranyakashipu, Lakshmi appears on the scene, and the Devas, and it seems more like an Aishwaryak, Vishnu-like, Vaikuntha-like environment, while Prahlad's deity is Krishna. So how to accommodate this in connection to the Bhagavatam verse, which says, according to how you worship, I reciprocate accordingly. So that's an interesting question, and I've heard that also sometimes. So it's nice also to see when I'm saying, oh, someone made this question some days ago, I'm not chastising any of you for saying the same question, because for sure you didn't know about that. And second, It's your own question in your own part of your process, and it coincides with other ones' same question in their own process. So for me, it's also interesting to see, okay, how nice, how a certain part of each one's journey, certain questions come, and those come from different people in different parts of the world at the same moment, if you will, or something like that. So that should happen. That's okay. So, What to say in that connection? Of course, again, Prahlad's deity is Krishna. Yeah, we are right. It's not Narasimhadev. But And we should say as Gaudiyas, and we spoke a little bit about that in our last the last Narasimha Chaturdasi that we celebrated in, that was North Carolina, and we chose to focus the topic by speaking about Mahaprabhu, and how Narasimhadeva appeared through Mahaprabhu so many times in the Leela, in the Gaur Leela. Because we try to go to all the things through Mahaprabhu, who is our Ishtadev in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And the conclusion was that, in one sense, Nisrimhadev is one aspect of Mahaprabhu. Of course, Nisrimhadev can be related to Vishnu and the avatars and Das avatars. But ultimately, if we, as Gaudiyas, play out the implications of our main line, Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam, as we were speaking these days in Brahma Stuti, Vishnu is an aspect of Krishna. So Narasimhadev is an aspect, if you want to think Narasimhadev is an aspect of Vishnu, and Vishnu is an aspect of Krishna, Narasimhadev is an aspect of Krishna, or an aspect of an aspect. So it's still Krishna, but appearing in a very unique way. According to the necessity of the moment, also. Not because the bigger picture is Hiranyakashipu, pray to Brahma, give me mortality. I cannot give you that, as we know Brahma say. So at least may I not be killed on heaven, on earth, during the day, during the night, all this long contract, list of conditions. And Brahma was like, it won't happen, you will be killed nonetheless, but okay. Okay, Mark, you got it. So for Brahma's promise not to be broken, we know Bhagavan appeared in a very specific form, so Brahma's promise is kept, and Hiranyakashipu is killed. And there was a need for it. Again, there's a bigger picture and a bigger picture, because even bigger picture is what? Narayan wants to taste Vira Rasa in Vaikuntha. He wants to taste the chivalry mood to have a good fight. That's part of Rasa. But he can only experience rasa with his devotees. But in Vaikuntha, nobody will be ready to fight with Narayan. Imagine. Everyone is mostly in Shanta rasa. Or some Dasya rasa. Imagine Narayan comes and says, come on, come. Let's come to the wrestling arena, four arms. It won't work. For the psychology of Vaikuntha, they will collapse. Vaikuntha will have to change his name. Vaikuntha means without anxiety. Everyone will be in anxiety if Narayan starts to invite everyone. Let's have some wrestling. But he wanted to taste that. So Jai, as we know, Jai and Bijai felt, we want to facilitate that. We want to offer ourselves for that to happen. And of course, the whole thing had to... So many layers of lilas happened for... facilitate that, no? Kumars come, Jai Vijay curse, falling from Vaikuntha, quote unquote, nobody falls from there. And they have to appear as demons to facilitate the situation, and in the context of that, the promise of Brahma. So my point is, all this is part of the necessity for Narayan to taste that, but and Prahlad appears in between the picture of the whole Leela, but Prahlad is a Krishna Bhakta, he's not a Vishnu Bhakta. So when he's seeing Narasimhadev, he's not seeing Vishnu. He's not even seeing Narasimhadev. He's seeing Krishna. He's seeing his deity. We are seeing Narasimhadev. Hiranyakashipu is seeing Narasimhadev, for sure. Death personified. But Prahlad is seeing Krishna. This is a very example of famous example of the birth of the... Many things we could say in that connection. According to your bhav, you will perceive the same person differently. That's how Krishna is defined as a multifaceted jewel. When Krishna entered the wrestling arena, there's a famous verse, Malanam, Asiranam, Ninam, Narabaram, Srinam, Smaro Murtimam, and so on, which shows how different people saw Krishna in different ways according to their rasa. And there the whole range of rasa is described, 5 main rasas and 7 secondary rasas. So for the woman, Krishna was the Cupid personified. For the Brajavasis, he was his relative. For Kansa, he was death personified. The same person. So try to get this point. That's a pretty different subjective experience. Cupid personified, death personified. Technically speaking, 2 different persons are there. But coming from the same person. You follow? No? Brishni paradiva titi. For the Brishnis, he was their deity. And so on. So my point is, the same person is there, but so many different perspectives are there. So again, someone may say, oh, Nrisimhadev broke the pillar and is killing Aranyakasipu. But Prahlad Maharaj is seeing Krishna. And his love, particular love for Krishna, is being experienced at that moment. Like what we were saying the other day, when Krishna in the Brahma Vimohan Lila, he expanded that as his friends, his calves. It was still Krishna, but in another form. So everyone loved those kids and calves like they loved Krishna. Even though it was not in the form of Krishna, it was in the form of a calf. But they loved the cow's heart for the calves was the love they have for Krishna. So they still were having the same experience of love for Krishna, for a calf. You follow my point? And Balaram himself, as we mentioned at the end of the year, was like, not only surprised, they are loving all of their calves more than Krishna. This is something weird. The mothers are loving their kids more than Krishna. That should be happening. But he himself was feeling that. He was still feeling, I'm so attracted to these calves. Like if they were Krishna. I love them like I love Krishna. Because of course it was Krishna. Brahma didn't know. I love these kids like I used to love Krishna. So the point is, no matter what form Krishna takes, be it Nrisimhadev, a calf, a friend, if you have a particular relationship with him, whenever he appears in whatever form, you will be feeling that. For other people, it may be something else, as we see with Hiranyakashipu. And then, yeah, Lakshmi may come. And again, the point comes there. Lakshmi comes. All this is to show light on the love of Prahlad, actually. The big main character of the whole Nrisimha Lila is Prahlad, actually. Nrisimhadeva appears for 5 minutes, deals with Hiranyakashipu, and game over. But Prahlad Maharaj is the one who is highlighted through the whole seventh canto of the Bhagavatam, mostly. And when Hiranyakashipu is killed, as we know, Nrisimhadeva is in Ugra Bhav, basically, angry mood, because he just killed the very personification of sin, so he had to enter into that dynamic. And the devas come there and they are praising, oh Bhagavan, more in Vishnu-like terms, Aishwarya. But nobody, I mean, they're praised for a considerable distance. No? Generally, by Kuntha, there's awe and reverence. Now there's more awe and reverence. No? More distance than even in Vaikuntha, because Vishnu is in, for them, Vishnu appeared in such a ferocious way that we never saw him like that. And Lakshmi Devi herself will say, I never saw him like that. What's going on? And they are afraid to get close to him, especially the devas. Because as my Guru says, the devas personify sakam bhakta, bhakti. Bhakti but still with material desires. And Nrisimhadev is a personification of killing material desires. So if you have material desires and you have the personification of killing that, you're like, oh, I don't know if I want to go too close to that. So all this is not so much to show everyone is in Vishnu, Aishwarya-like mood, but to make the position and contrast with how Prahlad Maharaj feels. And how Prahlad Maharaj feels, everyone is afraid, everyone is nervous, what to do, and nobody wants to get closer to pacify Nrisimhadev, and they look at Prahlad. Oh, Prahlad, you are our last resource, our last option, please go. And Prahlad Maharaj has no problem. I mean, Prahlad Maharaj was all time like absorbed and remembering and praising Krishna. He was not seeing there is a angry lion man there that may kill me or anything. He's seeing beyond that through the lens of his Baba and seeing his beloved Krishna. And so when someone says, please go to him, and Prahlad says, yeah, of course. He goes walking and he jumps on his lap. I mean, on the same lap that his father was killed a few minutes ago. So you say, the last place you want to jump to a lion is the lap. But he's not seeing lion, he's not seeing lap. He's seeing my Ista there. And he jumps there and immediately, with the contact of Prahlad, Nrisimhadev starts like to lick no, Prahlad, like if he will be a kitten. No? Ugra and Srinath disappear completely. No? So to make this point of Prahlad was in another frequency. And he was the only one able to... I mean, he was, again, seeing something in particular, but his frequency was such that he even changed the mood of Ugra and Srinath and the eyes of everyone else. Because he was connected to another aspect of divinity, which is Krishna, which has more to do with charm and intimacy and love. So for Prahlad, that was the currency. So naturally, that would... He even make that Vishnu side in the eyes of other ones, like, change and become totally... And then, of course, we have all these prayers and so on. So I will explain it like that, no, basically. No? So in Prahlad's eyes, there was never Vishnu, basically. There was never Nrisimhadev. No, it was only Krishna. No, that's the subjective perception through the lens of Baba. So according to one's, going back to the Bhagavatam verse, yeah, according to one's internal disposition, Bhagavan will show accordingly. So that, I mean, there's no contradiction with the verse. Prahlad has an internal disposition. How Bhagavan show him accordingly, so to him accordingly. But how Bhagavan showed to him, maybe we are not seeing that. We are just sharing a more general depiction of what appeared in the lens of Mose. In the lens of Hiranyakashipu, for sure. And that's the very idea of the whole Lila, no? Because Hiranyakashipu will say, I'm not seeing your God. And Prahlad say, like, where is your God? And Prahlad will say, where is my God not? He's everywhere. So the point is this, he's seeing something that everyone else is not seeing. So even when he appears, no, because Hiranyakashipu will say, I'm not seeing your God. So Nishinkata would say, here I am. So now Hiranyakashipu can say, okay, now I'm seeing it. I'm seeing what you are seeing, but still he's not seeing what Prahlad is seeing. He's seeing a particular form that Bhagavan will take according to what Hiranyakashipu needs to see and needs to deal with. Again, remember, this is one of Jaya Vijaya. He needs to have a good fight, so he cannot have a good fight with what Prahlad Maharaj is seeing. Because also Prahlad Maharaj's mood is Shanta Bhav, so it's more peaceful mood. But remember, Narayan wants to have a good fight. So he even cannot... the deity of Prahlad, what Prahlad is seeing, is not a deity that will offer a nice wrestling. No? So Hiranyakashipu is seeing something that lends itself towards arm to arm, neck to neck, all these dynamics. And even if you want to take that further, technically speaking, yeah, anyhow, that's another topic. I'm going too far now. So I think that's a good point to make, so a good question. So hope that helps.
Thank you
so much. Okay, so I think we will finish here, and tomorrow we will have... Today we have at the same time in the evening, 6:30 Bulgarian time, with Brahma Stuti, for those who would like to come. And tomorrow in the morning, we have Brahma Stuti in the morning. And at 5 p.m. Bulgarian time, we have another series of Q&A in Taran's place. That will be the last program here in Bulgaria. Monday morning, I'm leaving to Finland. Thank you so much for your time. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Giriraj Maharaj ki jai, Sri Sri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra ki jai, Sri Ekadasi ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari.